On this day, the 27th of February, 2023, I welcome all members here at M46 and on the virtual platform. I welcome the public protector and the legal team led by Alfred Mbofu here at M46, the evidence leaders, advocates Bawa and Mayosi, members of the media with us, our entire support staff, as well as the members of the public joining us for our continuing inquiry. Today, we welcome back the witness who would have taken an oath before, Ms. Mbuyana, who's with us here physically. You are still under oath. You wouldn't have to repeat that exercise. Welcome back. Would have paused at the time when we started with you on an issue of a statement that has subsequently been attended to. And as I recognize and invite Advocate Mpofu to start the proceedings with you. Welcome back again, and over to you, Advocate Mpofu.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I wanted to start by dealing with certain issues to do with witnesses, both the outstanding witnesses, and if you remember last week, there was also the issue of whether Mr. Linda, the driver, would be called by either Ms. Bauer or myself. I'm just mentioning that, Chair, because that's what I intended to do. But because of time, Advocate Bauer and I have not finalized those discussions. So in due course, maybe after tea, can I deal with those practical issues once we have some kind of understanding? Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Mbuyana. If you can press, yes.
Good morning.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to be asking you questions, probably for the day. And
yes, I forgot to indicate that. Thank you, Advocate Mpofu. Advocate Mpofu would have the day with you. We hope that he will spare some time and finish by tea, but he has the day.
Thank you. Yes, now we'll finish my tea tomorrow, Chair. Thank you. Okay, ma'am. So we'll see how it goes. And so what I'm going to do is, as I indicated, I think when we started last week, I had said that I was going to start by giving some introductory remarks, not for long, and then I will ask you specific questions. But I thought it might be appropriate. You know, they say Black people always start a speech with an apology. So I thought we'll start by apologizing for the two false starts that we had in your case, and also to thank you for coming here physically. We know that that's quite demanding, but we also prefer to have the hearing in remotely, but that just exposes us to all sorts of things, like being muted. So at least when we're here, we're able to have a decent hearing. Now, I wanted to, I'm going to, in this, hopefully, as I always say to the chair, to when I make these opening remarks, it's really to try and contextualize your evidence, okay? And hopefully then it makes, it saves time. So we waste a bit of time at the beginning in order to save time, because otherwise we can be here for the whole week chasing something that is not pertinent to the to this inquiry. Well, as a legally trained person yourself, I'm sure you've heard of the statement, favorite statement of lawyers, that context is everything, correct?
Correct.
And so these remarks that, and they'll be punctuated by a few questions, are also are meant exactly to do that. Maybe I should just ascertain from Ms. Bauer, I'm assuming that normally she would have given me an indication of which paragraphs in your statements are not in contention. And but I've done that exercise for her, so if she hasn't done it, she can confirm. I'm assuming that paragraphs 1 to 15 are not in contention, maybe with the possible exception of paragraph 8. You don't have to respond immediately, Advocate Bauer, but when I start with the questions, you can just check if that is correct. But even though that is so, I want to just confirm that you hold an LLB degree, correct, ma'am?
Correct.
And you joined the Public Protector in 2013 as a trainee investigator at the GGI, so-called GGI unit.
Correct.
Right. And broadly speaking, we'll come to this. Broadly speaking, you are here. There are various reports which form part and judgments which form part of this committee. You did not take part in most of those. You only took part in the so-called rogue unit investigation, correct?
Correct.
Of course, you took part in many other investigations, but as far as those relevant to this committee, it's the so-called rogue unit or SARS unit investigation, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Okay. Now, with that, then I'll make my opening remarks, Chairperson. And some will be directed at you, Ms. Mbuyana. The most important thing for the sake of context is that, and I want you to keep this in mind, this committee is not seized with determining whether or not there was a rogue unit. It's either there was a rogue unit or there wasn't. The work of this committee is different. If we were to establish the existence of the rogue unit, we would be here all week. You understand that?
Yes, I do.
Okay. This committee has been given certain judgments, and in particular with the rogue unit one, there's a judgment, excuse me, which was handed down by a court headed by Judge Bakwa, who is himself a former public protector. But putting that aside, so that's the judgment that is pertinent, and that judgment is judgment number 48521. Sorry. It's 48521/19 of the Gauteng Division. You are familiar with that judgment, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Now, here's the most important thing, which unfortunately has been missed in this commission, in this committee. Again, this committee, unlike what the evidence leaders have said, that the judgments are binding, and I think some of the members or most of the members operate from that incorrect premise that the judgments are binding to the committee and therefore they are what they purport to be. We hold a different view on that, but that's a matter that will be argued at the end. We hold the view that this is an inquiry. And I think maybe people don't know what the meaning of an inquiry is, but you can also maybe assist us because you are an investigator. And in a way, you are also an inquirer. If indeed, would you agree, and this might be relevant to when you talk about the other investigations like KPMG, Skakane, and so on. So if you were doing an investigation or an inquiry, but you consider yourself bound by some other inquiry or investigation, then would there be any point in doing that inquiry? Because after all, you are bound. You get where I'm going with this?
Yes, I do.
Yes. So the mere fact that we have something here called an inquiry into these judgments means that the committee must do exactly that, inquire into the findings that are made. Otherwise, we're wasting the taxpayers' time here because the judges have spoken. We should just spend one day to verify if there are judgments and then we go home. You understand?
Yes, I do.
Do you agree with that approach?
Yes.
And am I right that you yourself have said in your statement, for example, that despite there being several reports which had made findings, adverse findings on the so-called rogue unit, you did not regard yourself as bound by them, you still conducted your own inquiry and came to your own conclusions, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Well, we hope then that the committee will learn something from that approach. But let's put that aside of what an inquiry means. Yeah. Also, this inquiry is not about so much about the impeachment or non-impeachment of the public protector, although it's related to that, because that is the work of the National Assembly. This committee is really seized with inquiring into something much simpler, which is the veracity of the allegations of misconduct and incompetence on the part of the public protector as made by one Ms. Natasha Mazzoni, MP, and subsequently adopted by the majority of members in the National Assembly, mainly made up of the ANC and the DA. But the Ms. Mazzoni being the sponsor or the complainant, are you familiar with that history, General?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Now, let's take, for example, the issue of competence here. So there are those who come here believing that because the judgments have already pronounced on the issues of incompetence, for example, therefore it follows automatically that she must be incompetent. Now, if you approach the matter from that point of view, that there's a pronouncement of her incompetence and you are bound by that pronouncement, that would be tantamount to coming here with a predetermined outcome, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. Sorry.
And again, I want to refer it to your own experience. So if you came to the rogue unit, so-called rogue unit investigation, on the basis that, well, Mr. Sikakane has already found that it's unlawful, and therefore it must be unlawful, you would also be approaching the matter with a predetermined outcome, correct?
Correct.
And that would be disastrous, correct?
Correct.
All right. Because, as you know, again, as a lawyer, surely you know that holding a predetermined outcome for a process that's supposed to be fair, whether it is this committee or the public protector, is one of the most serious affronts you can have to our constitution if that process is supposed to be fair, correct?
That's true, correct.
So we shouldn't even waste the time of the taxpayers or this committee. If indeed the public protector is a person who approaches, or you as an investigator, or Mr. Mataboge, or anybody in your team, who approaches an investigation of this seriousness already with an outcome in mind, or one that you think you are bound by, then you might as well not be called the public protector, correct?
Yes, correct.
In fact, I can tell you personally, I would be the first one. If it was true that the public protector just looks at your face and decides whether you're guilty and then investigates, I would be the first citizen of South Africa to say she should be impeached. And I'm sure you would too, correct?
just a pause.
Sorry.
Just a pause. Advocate Mbowa.
Yeah, I didn't want to interrupt Advocate Mbowa because he said he was making some preliminary remarks, but he is leading the witness, and it is his witness. It's not ordinarily so that he's entitled to ask leading questions and solicit a correct answer indirect. He's not cross-examining this witness.
Thank you. Please keep yours on. Please keep your mic switch on. Thank you. Advocate Mbowa.
Chair, I've not even started asking the questions that I want to ask. I ask for your indulgence for me to make these opening remarks. And if you want me to make the opening remarks without reference to the witness's own experience or statement, then I'll do so. But I think it's better if I kill two birds with one stone, as I'm trying to do. In other words, making my remarks, but also relating that to what she has said in her statement, by the way, that she did not, regurgitate or cut and paste those other reports. So, Chair, if you allow me to continue like this, I will. But I'll be mindful that when I come to the content issues, then I ask the questions in a different style.
Okay, let's proceed in that way for now, Advocate Mbowa.
Thank you, Chair.
Proceed, Advocate Mbowa.
Thank you, Chair. All right, maybe let me do it like this, ma'am, so that indeed I'm trying to save the time of the committee by whatever I'm saying, not just saying it in the air, but situating it within the realities of this committee. Let me do this, maybe to make it easier for Advocate Mbowa. You have indicated in your statement, and I think it's common cause, that the key charges which relevant to your testimony, or the other way around, to which your testimony and that of Mr. Matabuge is relevant, are mainly charges 10 and 11. Sorry, I'm just getting a reference to the charge sheet, Chair. Okay, let me, just for the sake of completion, while we're looking for that, I think you've already said this, but just for the sake of completion, you are not here to testify on anything to do with the CX investigation, correct?
Correct, no.
You are not involved there?
No, I was not.
Neither are you here to deal with the Frieda investigation, and by that I mean Frieda 1. You are not involved in that either, correct?
No, yes, I was not involved. So it's correct.
And therefore, you are really here for charge 4, and charge 4 has got two broad elements. The first one is what we call the HR issues. We'll deal with that later. That's the issue of victimization and harassment and so on. You will assist the committee in so far as you can, simply because you are an employee there, and if these things were happening, you either might have seen them or experienced them, but we're not going to go too much into that. You understand that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So that in our language here is charge 10. That's the one that deals with harassment, victimization, and intimidation. So mainly you are here really for charge 11. So it's 10 and 11. And 11, Chair, if I may read it, I apologize. We haven't put it up yet, but I just don't want to waste time. Oh, yeah. It's bundle A, page 1. To 11. Simple.
Yeah, in the meantime, Ms. Mvuyana, if you could just shift towards this end and use that mic, because you're going to spend the whole day looking at that side. It's going to be better for you to do that.
Yes. And also, thank you, Chair. Also, try to speak into the mic because your voice is a bit soft.
Noted.
Thank you.
Just lift it.
Okay, just roll it up a little bit, Tsepo. I just want for the heading. Can you roll it up a little bit for the heading? Yeah. So that's charge number 4. You see that? And it has two components, 10 and 11. 10 is the one that we just spoke about, harassment and what have you. So we'll talk about that later in your evidence. And then 11, as I say, is the core charge that you are here for.
Yes, I am.
Okay. And 11.1, you don't have to worry about that. And 11.2, something to do with the legal costs. You don't have to worry about that. So the main charges that pertain to you are 11.3 and 11.4. And let me just read them out. It says that African Coban is guilty of misconduct in that committed misconduct by and or demonstrated incompetence in the performance of her duties by, let's jump, 11.1, 11.2, 11.3, failing intentionally or in a grossly negligent manner to conduct her investigation and or to make her decision in a manner that ensures the independent, impartial conduct of investigations and or by. And these two things are connected. So that failure is by deliberately seeking to avoid making findings against or directing remedial action in respect of certain public officials, while deliberately seeking to reach conclusions of unlawful conduct and impose far-reaching disciplinary measures and remedial action in respect of other officials, even where such conclusions and or measures and or remedial action manifestly had no basis in law or in fact. Again, as a legally trained person, I want you understand what the gist of that allegation is.
Yes, I do.
That it is not so much, as I said earlier, about whether some report is correct or not correct, or whether there's a rogue unit or there's no rogue unit or whatever. It's about the public protector deliberately and yourself, I suppose, and other people in your team, deliberately saying that there are certain public officials who must be targeted, against whom there must be a vendetta to find them guilty, no matter what the evidence says, but no matter what the facts say, on the one hand. And then there are other public officials who, no matter what the evidence says, no matter whether you even have a picture of them taking money from the till, must not be found guilty. That's why that's an impeachable offense. You and I will agree, correct?
Correct.
If it was indeed so that here there are two public officials. One is called Minister Heron. Other one is called Minister Minister Gondwe. And so the accusation is really this. Minister Heron, because he's the favorite, it doesn't matter. You can have a video of him stabbing somebody, but the public protector will not find him guilty. Meanwhile, Minister Gondwe, because she's not our favorite, could be as pure as snow, but if anybody accuses her of something, she's going to be found guilty just because it's her. That's really what the essence of this impeachment charge is. You understand that?
Yes, I understand.
Right. Now, let me tell you then that in this particular inquiry, the people who fall under the Minister Heron category, the untouchables who will always be absolved, are, according to the evidence presented to this committee, people like Mr. Ace Magashule and Mr. Musebenzi Zwane. So it is said that the public protector had evidence against them, but absolved them. You've been following the inquiry, correct?
Yes, partially.
Partially, yes. Mm-hmm. And then the other people who fall under the Minister Conway category, according to the evidence here, are Mr. Godan, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, and to some extent, Mr. Pillay. So those are the people that, according to what keeps us here for the past 7 months or 8 months, those are the people against whom it doesn't matter if they've done nothing wrong. You and the public protector and Mr. Matabuhe and the people at the public protector will always find them guilty. You understand that?
Yes, I understand.
Right. So that's the essence of why you are here. It's not about whether there was a rogue unit or not. It's whether that theory of the evidence leaders, or rather, I'm sorry, of Ms. Mazzoni is sustainable. In which case, as I say, if it is, then I'll be the first one to agree that with Ms. Mazzoni that there should be an impeachment. But let's inquire into that. All right. Now, let me start by saying this, Chair, and I'm now getting into the meat. Would you agree as a general proposition that if there was indeed such a conspiracy to target in the pursuance of a vendetta, people like Mr. Ramaphosa or Mr. Godan or Mr. Pillay, at least insofar as that pertains to the rogue unit, so-called rogue unit investigation, you would be have to be part of that conspiracy, correct?
Yes, for it to work.
To succeed, yes. Yeah. In other words, remember, you are not facing impeachment proceedings. It's really the public protector who's facing impeachment proceedings.
Yes.
But for her to be guilty of this heinous offense envisaged in charges 11.3 and 11.4, it would be impossible to carry it out without enlisting the co-conspiratorial cooperation of people like yourself and Mr. Matabuha. Correct?
Please explain conspiratorial.
Yes.
Conspiracy.
Okay. Now let me simplify it. That she would. It would be. Let me ask you one question before. You, according to what I consider to be the non-contentious part of the statement, you were the investigator in the so-called rogue unit investigation, correct?
Correct.
Now,
just try and raise your voice as you respond.
Yes.
So that please clearly get it on record.
Yes, please, because the majority of the members are online, so I'm sure if we are struggling being here, then I'm sure they're struggling even more.
I'll try my best.
Good, thanks. And in fact, that's good. Also be as close to the mic as possible here. All right. Now, I'm just going back to, instead of using those big words, to break it down into. So you are the investigator, right?
Yes.
Now, just explain to us as if we were coming from Mars, how that works. Because remember, us and the members of the public, the things that you might take for granted because you work there are not generally known out there, correct?
As far as I'm aware, yes.
Yeah. So please then assist us as members of the public and as members of the committee. So am I correct that in a team of an investigation of this nature, you would have, let's call it on the ground, at the ground level, as we say out there, would be someone like you, that's the foot soldier on the ground, the investigator?
Yes.
In a typical investigation, I know it didn't apply to this one, the next level would be you would be reporting to a senior investigator, correct?
Yes.
That's number two. That person, the senior investigator, then reports to a chief investigator, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
The chief investigator reports to the executive manager, correct?
Yes, correct.
The executive manager reports to the COO or sometimes the acting COO, depending, correct?
That's correct.
And then the COO reports to the public protector and DPP. Let's just say the public protector.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So that's the point I'm making. So therefore, these five, sometimes four, sometimes three, steps are the people, including the public protector, who would have to be part of this conspiracy to condemn the target of the vendetta, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Yes. Now, and I want you to say this very clearly to the committee, because I think it's not understood. The person or the people who actually do the investigation work are the investigators in that chain that I explained. Not even the EM, really. Let's say it would be the investigator, the senior investigator, and the chief investigator. Those are the people who do the nuts and bolt investigation, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And therefore, I'll put it as strongly as this, that it is, would you agree, the public protector will, when she testifies, explain this as well in detail. But I just want to test this with you because I can't call you after the public protector, so I have to take advantage of you being here now. She's going to tell the committee that, and put it as strongly as this, it is impossible, literally impossible, for her to carry out this kind of conspiracy that she's being accused of if she did not have, I don't know, to bribe or recruit or get people like you and the senior investigator and the investigator to be part of that conspiracy. Will you agree with her?
It would practically be impossible to recruit without recruiting us.
Yes.
To achieve the conspiracy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's correct.
Thank you. Right. So in a way then, you are, I'm sorry to say this, in the dock as much as she is. Because you would have, for this thing to be sustained, you would have to be in on it somehow. Or at the very least, maybe turn a blind eye, you know, wink, wink kind of arrangement, even if you were not a full-time member of the conspiracy. But certainly you'd have to overlook certain evidence, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
And also be in agreement.
With the conspiracy.
Yes.
Yes. Right. That, I pressed the wrong button, sorry, Chair. No, excuse me, I didn't intend to cough aloud. Yeah, sorry, ma'am, you'll forgive me, I still have a lingering flu. Right. Okay. So we've done the. And in this hierarchy that I've explained, I'm not even counting other people like the quality control people and those kinds of people. I'm just counting the management people. But obviously, those people would also have to be to turn a blind eye to these glaring anomalies. Correct?
Yes, but they'd only see those anomalies when they receive the draft report.
Correct. Okay. No, fair enough. So by then, obviously, maybe some of the concealment would have already happened. Is that what you're saying? That they may not necessarily have to be members of the conspiracy because they may only encounter it at the time of the draft report.
Well, the draft report would detail the investigation process. They are not involved in the investigation process.
Right.
So they'd have to overlook, clearing anomalies.
And deficiencies.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. All right. Well, that's what the public protector has accused of. But in truth, then, the foundational stone or the foundational stone of this conspiracy would have to be the investigator, because you are the person who's unearthing things, requiring things, and asking questions or suggesting which questions should be asked, correct?
The person who would actually be, if I'm understanding your question correctly, are you saying that the person would actually have the conspiracy is the investigator? So would have bias against?
Yes, the person would be the implementer, let me put it that way, of the conspiracy would have to be the investigator.
But then where did the conspiracy come from?
No, it comes from the public protector. Let's say, on this theory, the leader of the conspiracy is the public protector. But I'm saying for her to execute it, the investigator, and I don't mean you, any investigation. The investigator is the person who's involved with the actual spade work of that investigation, correct?
The investigator is involved in the spade work.
Uh-huh.
If they are in agreement with the public protector to have a conspiracy against a certain individual, then the investigator will carry out the spade work, inclusive of anyone that's in the team, hypothetically speaking.
Yes. Yeah, no, we're still there. Believe me, we think this is all hogwash, yeah. But I'm just talking the hypothetically, yeah, as you correctly point out. Okay. Now, let's move then away from the mechanics of what it is that the public protector is being accused of. And let's now go to the so-called evidence that has been placed before this committee. I've already explained to you that evidence, quote unquote, is primarily in the form of court judgments.
Yeah.
You understand that? And I told you that there are two schools of thought as to whether those court judgments are cast in stone or whether they are susceptible of being inquired into. The evidence leader and the people like Honorable Mulder and others believe that those judgments are cast in stone and are binding as such at face value. Now, again, as a legally trained person, you would know that the judgments, the judges didn't just wake up one day and make those findings. Those are based on the evidence presented to them, correct?
Correct.
So the real source of the accusations, whether it's bias or dishonesty or conspiracy or what have you, the real source would be the people who brought that case to court. Those allegations, making those allegations against the public protector, correct?
Yes, the people who made the application, yes.
Yes. And in the case of the so-called rogue unit report, I will show you later, those allegations came primarily from Mr. Godin. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I am aware.
And you're aware that Mr. Godin was also the applicant in those cases that led to those judgments, correct?
Yes, the rogue unit judgments.
Yes. And that Mr. Godin then made various allegations, including accusing the public protector of being part of state capture and corruption and what have you. In other words, the basis for that so-called conspiracy was political motives and all sorts of things. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I do recall.
Yeah. And in fact, you would be aware that Mr. Godin made those allegations, in fairness to him, even in the response to your Section 7-9 inquiry.
Yes, Section 7-9 notice.
Section 7-9 notice, yes. And therefore, that's really the source of this conspiracy theory that has brought us here today, correct?
Allegedly.
Yes. In other words,
didn't get that. You're saying?
Allegedly. No, I say allegedly because it's not the only charge, I believe.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. It's not. No, okay. Maybe I didn't ask the question properly. Confining it to the so-called rogue unit related charges. Let me put as between the judgments and the statements made by the people who make the statements in the affidavit, such as Mr. Gordon, which of the two is the basic source of the allegations? Is it the judgment or is it the people who brought the cases to court?
It is the judgments. Because the people who brought it to court, there were two judgments. The first judgment was setting aside the remedial action or interdicting the remedial action.
Uh-huh.
And then the second judgment then set aside the report.
Yes.
Obviously, the reason for those reports was because Mr. Kostan made an application to court.
Yeah.
Alleging the allegations that you said that the PP was biased and that the investigation was not conducted properly.
Okay, then your answer then is twofold here. I need you to clarify it now. Of the between the judgments and the Mr. Gordon, let's put it bluntly. Yeah. Who is the original source of the allegations of conspiracy?
Mr. Gordon.
Thank you. And therefore, if we are here to inquire into those allegations which originated from Mr. Gordon, is it possible or conceivable or logical that Mr. Gordon can be said to be irrelevant to the inquiry into his own allegations?
No. He made the allegation, so he should support his allegations.
Right. Thank you. Anyway, that is unfortunately the view of this committee, is that somebody like that, who's the real origin of these charges, is quote unquote irrelevant. But that's a story for another day. It's the same with Mr. Ramaphosa. Now, while we're there, in your statement, you say that correctly, that the three persons were the primary focus of the so-called rogue unit investigation were Mr. Gordon, Mr. Pillay, and Mr. Mahashula, Mr. Opa Mahashula. Do you confirm that?
Yes, I do.
And you then say in that order. So can you explain what you mean by that? Who was, of those three, who was the most important source or focus of the investigation and source of the allegations and the charges?
If we had to say main, would have been Mr. Gordon. The first allegation relating to the report was a violation, an allegation of the violation of the EMIR. That can only be investigated against the minister, of course. I think it's we are all aware that who the complainant was. So the public protector was then bound to investigate that complaint. So Mr. Gordhan is the only person that the allegation was made against there. The second portion of the investigation, so that's the other issues related to Mr. Gordhan in relation to the fact that he was the former accounting officer of SARS. And that was how he then became almost a center. Yes. The second order, which would have been Mr. Pillay then became the commissioner after Mr. Gordhan became the Minister of Finance, I believe. After Mr. Pillay left, it was then Mr. Makhashula. So they were the accounting officers who were involved in the alleged maladministration and improper conduct.
Okay. Thank you.
So I suppose I see a hand. Honorable Ngola.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you. No, Chair, I just wanted to add that we use the full names of statutes or whatever. And not abbreviations for the benefit of the public. I'm sure.
Just repeat that. I missed that. I didn't hear you.
I wanted to add say that we use full name.
Full name. Full name, okay.
Not abbreviation for the benefit of the public, because I think a lot of people would not know what a media is in its full context. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Ngola.
Yes.
Advocate Mpofu, over to you.
Noted, thank you, sir. I'll do it once, and then if I say Emil afterwards, then thank you, Honorable Ngola. But I just wanted to say, we'll come back to the Emil point here. Just to round up the point that you've just made, the judgment, I want to refer to the judgment, I think it's bundle A, 4016, the so-called rogue unit judgment. That's case number 48521.
Is it involved with the full bench or the partial judgment?
The full bench.
It's bundle C. Number 3. It's judgment number 18.
Number 3, 118.
No, 18. 18, 18.
18, thank you. Anyway, yes. Chair, again, to save time while they're looking for it, I'll just read it out. Oh, there you are. Okay, just go to paragraph 1.
You can switch off, Advocate Bauer. Your mic. Thank you.
Okay.
Switch on your mic, Ms. Mvuyana.
Thank you. Yes. I just want to say that, yeah, it looks like at least the judge...
Switch it on.
On.
Yours must stay on. Thank you.
Yes. I just wanted to say that, I wanted to round it off. The judges seem to agree with you at least on this, on what this whole case was all about. The very opening paragraph of the judgment says the following. On 5 July 2019, the public protector released a report, quote, on an investigation into allegations of violations of the Executive Ethics Code by Mr. Pravin Gordhan, MP, as well as allegations of maladministration, corruption, and improper conduct by the South African Revenue Services, called the report. Then says, apart from the adverse findings made against Minister Gordhan, the report also implicates Mr. Viswanathan Pillay and Mr. George Ngakane Virgil Mahashule, the latter both former employees of the South African Revenue Services, in serious misconduct, maladministration, and criminality. So does that accord with your understanding of what this whole business was all about, that the report implicated Mr. Minister Gordhan, Mr. Pillay, and Mr. Mahashule? And as I say, they are also listed in the order that you have just described.
Yes, I do.
Right. So according to then this other theory, it's possible that Mr. Pillay can be relevant, but Mr. Gordhan, who's number one on the list, can be not relevant. But as I say, that's a matter that we will discuss at another stage.
Sorry, relevant to?
To the inquiry. Yes.
Oh.
I mean, to this inquiry. Or to the issues that brought you and all of us here. Now, you've also said that as far as the you've said that as far as what later we will call part one of the, or maybe let me do it like this. Is it correct as stated in your statement, and I think it's common cause because it was also put to Mr. Mataboha, that you received the complaint, or at least one of the complaints from a Mr. Shivambu, who's a member of parliament? Correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And it's a requirement of the EMEA Act that, for Mr. Ngola's benefit, is the Executive Members Ethics Act. You agree that's what EMEA stands for?
Yes.
It's just the abbreviation. Yeah. It's a requirement of that act, Executive Members Ethics Act, that the complaint must come from a member of parliament. It can't come from me or my attorney or my learned colleagues.
Yes, that is true.
Yes. And you've already said it must also be against a member of the cabinet.
Yes, or a member of parliament.
Or a member of parliament, yeah. Actually, no, I think it's the...
Member of parliament, like me?
No.
Thank you.
No, the,
please attend to that.
No, member of parliament like Mr. Chanti, if he doesn't get... to be part of the reshuffle that is mooted, he would not be a target of EMEA, correct?
No.
Yes. Well, we might be saved by the gong. But be that as it may,
committee has got important work to do. And it will continue and complete its business.
Thank you, Chairperson.
With the chair. Thank
yeah,
you.
Well, then there might be an EMEA investigation. But all right. Now, so insofar as the report, the what you call the investigation was split into two parts. The first part, which dealt with EMEA and other things, we'll come to that. Of these three people, would be focusing specifically on Mr. Godin, correct? The EMEA part.
Yes, the EMEA part was specifically on Mr. Godin.
Yes. And therefore, insofar as the allegations of the conspiracy relate to the EMEA part, they would be originating specifically from Mr. Godin again, correct?
The conspiracy
allegations, insofar as they are sought to explain the EMEA investigation. In other words, it's a sham investigation, it's a fake investigation, it's driven by political considerations and all those things. As far as that relates to the EMEA part of the investigation, those would emanate from Mr. Godin.
Yes, they would.
Mm. Yes. Right. All right. Now, oops. Sorry, chat. Okay, Chair, I've just misplaced the document, but I'll improvise. Now, let's then get to the judgment. We've spoken about the Section 7-9 notice. And I'm going to take you through that in much more detail. But just for the benefit of the members, can you just explain what a Section 7-9 notice is? Briefly.
Okay. Section 7-9 notice is an interim report, as it used to be called, that is issued before a report is finalized.
Mm-hmm.
So it offers whoever is implicated in the investigation or whoever has to implement remedial action an opportunity to respond. So either on the findings that are being made against them or on the remedial action that they would have to implement. And that's basically it. It's an audi alteram partem process.
Right. In other words, for those of us who are not as familiar with this as you are, can I simplify it like this? You do an investigation, you make adverse findings against me based on your investigation, and then you have to send me a Section 7-9 notice so that I have my audi alteram partem opportunity to refute your findings.
Yes, the possible findings will be made if you do not provide other evidence.
Yes, as you said, the provisional findings.
Yes.
Now, those provisional findings, depending on my response, if I say to you, well, go and jump in the lake, they might then translate into actual findings.
Yes.
Scenario two, if I give you a complete explanation of that, no, this is not what it looks like. It's because, you know, I know in your report you say I had this bottle here next to me, therefore it looks like I might have stolen it, but I've got a receipt where I bought it and what have you, and here's the receipt. Then you find that your provisional findings will then go away, correct?
Not 100%, it's not guaranteed unless you do provide evidence that shows that you actually have the slip. Now we still have to compare if the slip is actually yours, did you pay for it, and then we then make a determination based on that.
Right.
So we still have to analyze the evidence that you would have provided as well before making any finding.
Very good.
It's not guaranteed that the
it's
finding
not guaranteed.
Will be.
Okay. But if even after that, then I not only provide the slip, I even provide that, you know, video evidence of me buying the bottle, and it's clear that I have 100% explanation, then your findings would not be adverse, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Yeah. So that's scenario two. And then scenario three is I give you, I say, yeah, well, I know that it looks like that bottle, but yeah, I mean, all bottles look the same and so on. So I don't give you something 100% concrete, but I give you some explanation which you don't accept. Then, of course, the findings, your provisional findings in that scenario might also be confirmed, correct?
Yes, they might be confirmed.
Right. Okay, fine. Then now we know what Section 79 is and what its purpose is. Okay. Now, before the thing I was looking for, just I'm sorry to jump back to that. I just wanted to tie that up. In that paragraph that I showed you in the judgment, is it correct that the Mr. Van Lochenberg is not mentioned?
Yes, in the paragraph he's not mentioned.
Yes. And you've said in your statement that the theory that Mr. Van Lochenberg was an implicated person, yes, thank you, is false.
Yes, it is.
Yes. Why do you say that? What was the role of Mr. Van Lochenberg in this, if he was not an implicated person?
In our investigation, we focused on the conduct of maladministration and improper conduct. So when the finding of maladministration and misconduct was made against the accounting officers or the former accounting officers, based on the fact that they are the decision makers and took the decisions that were taken in terms of the report. So Mr. Van Lochenberg, yes, was a part of the alleged unit or alleged SARS rogue unit, but did not take part in any decision making. So that would be in the establishment, in the recruitment of staff, which were mostly a higher level, procurement of equipment, he would also have played no part. So he would not have approved memos granting approval for SARS to actually go ahead with those purchases or implement certain decisions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Because I think there's some confusion about that. Thank you. And is it also correct, and again we'll go to the actual Section 79 notice, is it is it also correct that Mr. Van Lochenberg's involvement was more located in what was to be known as part two, in other words, the deferred part of the investigation?
Yes, the allegations made against him directly were referred to part two.
Yes. And as far as the Emir, Chairperson, just for the, from Mr. Ngola's...
No, I think you have firmly placed the understanding of Emir.
Yes, fully, no.
So you can continue using
Emir. Yes, no, I will, Chair. But
unless there's a new one you
thinking of. No, I was just saying for, in case Honorable Ngola forgets, it's in paragraph 16 of the statement. It's put there in full, Executive Members Ethics Act, and then in brackets, EMEA. So then I agree with you, Chair. Then from now on, I think I'll feel free to just call it EMEA. And there, paragraph 16, that's the one on the screen there. Thank you.
Matter is closed.
It's closed now, definitely, in writing. And there in that paragraph, since we have it, I'm just reading it for completion because you've already made the point. You say, Mr. Godan played a central role in the investigation due to the fact that as a minister, he was the only person who could be subjected to EMEA, as well as being the former accounting officer of SARS. His conduct was therefore the primary focus of the investigation, especially part one, which was the subject matter of the relevant report and the judgment, which forms part of the charge or motion. That confirms what the evidence that we've just gone through, correct?
Yes, it does.
Right. And just for the sake of completion, so that we don't go back to this, from that evidence, you're also saying, apart from being a minister, which he is now, or he was then when you were doing the investigation, he was also primary because he had been the commissioner for SARS and therefore the accounting officer in terms of the PFMA in that respect, correct?
Correct.
Yes. Now, you talk about maladministration. And again, I think it goes back to the point where we started this morning, that these things are not so much about whether there was a rogue unit or even whether a rogue unit, so-called rogue unit or investigation unit or whatever you call it, whether it is a good thing or a bad thing. Am I correct that yours was merely to find out if there had been breaches of, for example, the PFMA or any other law?
That is correct. Also, I think it was covered in the report that the intention of the public protector is not to stop anyone from doing anything if we were to specifically talk about the intelligence unit now. That the SARS can have a unit that is obviously is going to investigate taxpayers that are non-compliant, etc. Our main focus was whether or not legislation was adhered to in the conducting of those operations, especially in the establishment of the operations. And yeah, that was based on a complaint that we received.
Yes. Yeah, I know we'll come to the complaint, but I think this is an important point to make. So let me think, I'm trying to think of an example. Let's assume then that this whole investigation was about the most benevolent, the most important thing. Let's say the securing of ambulances for elderly people, okay?
Mm.
Which is a good thing.
Mm.
Yours was not to check whether the ambulances for old people is a good thing or a bad thing. Yours is to check whether the procurement of those ambulances, were the prescripts followed, the PFMA, whatever, the Ambulance Act, or whatever it is. And that's all, really. You don't get involved in the whether it's a good thing or a bad thing situation. Correct. Thank you. And when we get to the report, Chair, that point is very specifically made in the report itself. All right. And while we are there, we might then as well for the committee break down the various aspects of the unit that you are looking at. And maybe you can explain in your own words. The first one, as a, if I read the documents, was the establishment of the unit, correct?
Yes, the allegations.
What does that mean, the establishment? In what were you looking into there, in short?
The formation. So we were looking at the request that was then written to Mr. Manuel, Mr. Trevor Manuel,
uh-huh.
was the Minister of Finance at the time. The operations, so the kind of responsibilities that the unit had, and how would they achieve those? That would basically be the establishment.
Okay.
Now,
what else did you look into apart from the establishment?
How, what else? Oh,
yes.
You mean the other allegations?
Yes.
So it was also the procurement,
okay.
Alleged procurement of equipment for that particular unit.
Okay, just a minute. So the second leg would be procurement of equipment. And
yes.
In that, what would you be looking at, broadly speaking?
Procurement processes that need to be adhered to in terms of the PFMA and National Treasury regulations, memos that were drafted and we obtained that were supposed to have been obtained approval,
mm-hmm.
What the equipment was for, etc., that would have been contained in the memos. That was the kind of things that we usually look at in procurement matters.
Yes, good. Yes. What else? What was the other leg that you looked into in this specific?
Part one.
Yes.
The recruitment processes.
Okay, just a minute. Recruitment processes. Okay, under that leg, what kind of things would you be looking at?
In that leg, the kind of evidence that we would request or that we'd look at as well. Adverts for the positions, memos detailing the need for the positions, what was the reason for the positions being created, CVs, application forms, qualifications, memos as well, indicating interview processes, who would be appointed and why they appointed, so that would include your scoring sheets.
Uh-huh.
Who would be in the interview panel, and appointment letters. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. And that would involve HR policies, the applicable
yes.
HR policies and so on. Good. Any other leg?
The second to last leg was the operations of the alleged unit
uh-huh.
was also looked into. In that instance, the evidence requested and obtained would have related to the operations of the unit. So how they conducted their activities
uh-huh.
and who conducted those activities
uh-huh.
and the reasons for conducting those activities. Basically.
Good. Thank you. You know, I think that gives us the landscape here. Yeah. Now, when it comes to, no, it's fine, I'll take you through these four legs or so when we traverse the section 7-9 in more detail. Mr. Godin, the allegations against him of these legs, which one was, or which ones were more relevant to him?
Allegation one, EMEA, is already established that.
Uh-huh.
Allegation two, the establishment.
Establishment.
Yes.
Of the unit.
Of the unit.
Uh-huh.
Allegation three, the procurement.
Uh-huh.
And allegation four. 4 or D of the report, which is the recruitment processes.
Recruitment. Okay, fine. Okay, okay. And let's not get into detail, but those were pertinent to him, or rather, he was relevant to those allegations.
Yes.
Okay, all right. Now, you went into a lot of detail. I think you say in your statement that this investigation was done in a very thorough manner.
Yes.
Can you broadly just support that statement?
In my understanding and my explanation of Dara, the processes of the investigations of the public protector were followed. So at the beginning of an investigation is consultations, meetings, assessment of the complaint, mm-hmm. trying to understand what the complainant is trying to say. In this instance, we even met with the complainant who had a very detailed complaint, and very long complaint as well. We met and he explained and qualified all the allegations made. Thereafter, we wrote to SARS with relations to the EMEA part of the investigation. We were required to write to the president to inform him that we had received a complaint from an MP against Mr. Gordhan. We also wrote to Mr. Gordhan, informing him that we have received a complaint and these are the allegations made. We listed all the allegations. We received responses from both SARS and Mr. Gordhan, except, of course, the president is not required to respond. Those documents and received from both Mr. Gordhan and SARS were analyzed thoroughly. So when I say thoroughly is that we actually sat down and looked at the document and not just skimmed through the documents or and actually applied our minds, because I remember that one of the allegations that is that we didn't take into consideration a particular 2014 or 2016 matter. So in that instance, once SARS notified us that there was an investigation previously done by the PPSA, we went and looked for the file. I personally went. We found the file and found the response of Mr. Pillay at the time. I think it was it's a 2014 uh-huh. Letter. That was also considered. What was relevant to our investigation was considered, mm-hmm. and we began then issuing subpoenas or trying to get the main role players to provide answers in terms of what we had discovered and to provide more information, etc. Subpoenas were then issued to Mr. Makhasule, Mr. Pillay, Mr. Gordhan, and we tried to also subpoena a response from Mr. Van Lochrenberg, mainly for the operations part. Everyone responded. So everyone being Mr. Pillay, Mr. Gordhan, Mr. Makhasule responded to the subpoenas that had been served on them. Once we had received the responses, we went through them and incorporated them into what evidence that we had already began jotting down, because we don't just sit with evidence, we have to actually put it on paper so that we can get a picture of what actually happened here. Once that was done, we then discussed the matter in length with the relevant officials, that being the team. Once that was done, I think everyone has seen the emails to and fro. Once that was done, the Section 7-9 was issued to Mr. Gordhan, Mr. Pillay, Mr. Makhasule. We then awaited responses from them. Responses were received. the investigation was finalized.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Chair, if you can bear with me and maybe take the break 5 minutes late. I just want, before, because I'm going to take you in detail through the Section 7-9 statement, which really, I think, succinctly encapsulates what would be both your version and the version of the public protector. So again, it kills two birds with one stone, because when the public protector testifies, she will also use that as her blueprint of how you did this. But you've just summarized broadly how you went about doing the, what you call the Tara investigation.
Yes.
But the reason why I'm asking the chair to give me the indulgence so that we can do that when we come back from the break is because I just want to kill one issue which arises from what you've just described. A lot of heavy weather has been made about the failure by the public protector to serve a subpoena on Mr. Van Lochenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I want to preface this by making it clear of what exactly she's being accused of by Mr. Van Lochenberg and others. Okay, it's not so much that she did not serve the subpoena on Mr. Van Lochenberg or any, or her office did not. That's common cause, right? What is really being alleged is that that non-service, and that's why we're here in an impeachment room, for lack of a better word, it is that that lack of service was not, it was an act, it was deliberate. In other words, the public protector or whoever, you or someone else, specifically went out of their way to ensure that Mr. Van Lochenberg does not get the subpoena in the pursuance of the grand conspiracy of making findings against Mr. Godin because he is one of the people who must be condemned no matter what. You understand that?
If I may ask before you continue,
right.
What's the connection between Ms. Van Lochenberg and Mr. Godin?
Yes. Okay. In this theory of mine. Yes. Okay. Now, it is this, that in order to falsely condemn Mr. Godin, one of the things that you and the public protector had to do was to make sure that you do not get information from Mr. Van Lochenberg, because Mr. Van Lochenberg was the head of the unit. And if you had gotten the information from him, you would have realized that this whole thing is just nonsense. So you actively and deliberately wanted not to hear from him. Do you understand the theory? Again, it's nonsense.
Yes, yes,
but
I understand.
You understand it? Yes. Okay. So that's the real issue. So it's not so much about service or non-service. Yeah. Now, firstly, I'm going to ask you that what steps did you take to ensure that Mr. Van Lochenberg is subpoenaed? Because you just counted him among the people. You say you did your thing, you spoke to the complainant, you looked at the document, you listed what you, I think you called role players, or maybe you used another word. And he was one of those role players, and therefore you subpoenaed the role players, including him. What steps did you then take to ensure that you don't just serve the subpoenas on the other 6 role players, but deliberately hold back on this one of Mr. Van Lochenberg, as it is alleged? What steps did you take?
Okay, I'll just start with, in any investigation, that I have conducted, and I think most of my colleagues, Mr. Kortan, Mr. Pile, and Mr. Mahashul. I'll start with them first because they were the ones that actually received the subpoena.
Yes.
Mr. Kortan, we had his contact details. When you Google Minister of Public Enterprises, you get the email address of the PA. You can call the PA, easy access. Mm. We even have the attorneys of record that usually respond on his behalf. So, and there'd been previous investigations. So another colleague would have easily given me his contact details.
Mm.
That same goes with Mr. Pillay and Mr. Mahashun.
Mm.
The information was readily available within the institution of the PPSA. Now, Mr. Van Lokerenberg, as the investigator, I'd never met him. I don't know him. I just know that he was an employee of SAR. So once that was done, we then discussed with Mr. Matabuke as the supervisor, hey, we need to find this guy. So this guy being Mr. Van Lokerenberg, and we need to find out how we're going to serve him.
Right.
We don't have an email address for him. We don't have a cell phone number or a telephone number, and he has resigned from SARS. Luckily, we had just met or had already met with a whistleblower who was within SARS at the time when we were conducting the investigation, requested to remain anonymous. When we were then trying to figure out what to do, we then resolved that, no, let's call. Should I continue or wait?
Yes, I'm
sorry.
Continue, don't be disturbed about the body languages.
No, I was trying to attract the attention of Advocate Bauer, but I'm not succeeding. It's fine, I'll talk to her during the break here. Yeah. Okay, sorry about that.
Please proceed.
All right. So, we met with a whistleblower who was within SARS, employed at SARS, in the HR division. Yes.
Don't reveal too much.
Yes, but no, I want to reveal that because they had easy access to getting that information. SARS is a big institution. Some people didn't even know or still don't know Mr. Van Lokerenberg within SARS. We contacted Mr. Anonymous or Miss Anonymous, and they then provided us with the address. The person who called Miss or Mr. Anonymous was Mr. Matabu, due to protocol.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was provided the address. I drafted the subpoena, provided the address. We put the address on the letterhead, which then submitted to the public protector for signature. So all four went together for signature and came back signed. It was then the three were emailed to the relevant parties. So Mr. Pillay, Mr. Gordans, and Mr. Mahashule were emailed. And then because we don't have an email address for Mr. Van Lokerenberg, when our whistleblower / Ms. or Mr. Anonymous came back, they just had that address and stated that there was nothing else on the personnel file. So they did not have a telephone number or forwarding address that they had on record at SARS. So we then took the address. We do, and we have to serve subpoenas physically. We use the services of Mr. David Linda at the time, who's a driver/messenger. I requested Mr. Linda to go and serve the subpoena. Mr. Linda agreed and he went to serve the subpoena. He asked because he usually asks if he's going to serve, if he can have the cell phone number of the person that, and we stated that, no, we don't have a cell phone number for this person. Just let's go try this address that we received. He then went and came back and said, no, he couldn't find Mr. Van Lochelenberg. He said he'll try again tomorrow. He went the next day and then came back with the fact that Mr. Van Lochelenberg was not in that address and had either moved or had never even, we're not sure what happened. But yeah, what he told me was that we will never find that guy. That's what the caretaker told him, that we'll never find the guy even if we wanted to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Now, okay, thank you for that.
That's where our 5 minutes take us.
Okay. That's fine. That's fine. Yes, that's a good point, Chair. I'll ask you one more aspect on this, and then we'll move to the 7-9. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. We will take a 10-minute break and back at 10-2. Thank you.
Recording stopped.